Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Tanya the Communication Doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do. Hello and welcome to Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. Lovely to welcome Dr. Gail on my show today. And Dr. Gail is an international thought leader. So welcome, Dr. Gail. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm excited and delighted.
And you know what? I must admit, I do love your accent. So can you just tell my audience where you're calling from?
Absolutely. I am calling from the U.S. I'm in North Carolina, near a little place called Charlotte, North Carolina. So I am in the southeastern part of the United States.
Mm, oh, I love that. And you know what? I've never been to North Carolina. I've been to many different places in the States. New York, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Carolina. So, but you know what? It's interesting. You know, TV, you get an idea through TV and movies. It's good to speak to people to get a real idea as to what's really going on. Now, one of the reasons that I approached you for Real Stories was because I was watching some of your posts on LinkedIn. And an amazing post when you talked about how people should talk to black people, you know, how white people talk to black people. And it made me think, I thought about white fragility and Dr. D'Angelo. And I also was thinking about Renee Edo Lodge, who's a British author of Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race, which is another really powerful book.
And she's okay.
British. Mm-hmm. So, and I loved all your background, but you know, you're an international thought leader. What led you to have that conversation on LinkedIn? Just want to know that.
Well, I've been having a conversation all my life. my father was in the army. And so when I was 5 years old, he moved me out of the black community into the international community. I went to live in Asia, where I had my first experience. And my parents didn't tell me I was black. All I knew, my grandmother told me I was pretty and smart. And that's what I believed.
Brilliant.
I thought everybody knew that. So I remember going to Okinawa to school, and I started school there. And there was this little boy who sat in front of me, and he would cradle his hand on the back of his chin and always turn around and look in my face. Uh-huh. And the teacher had to constantly tell him to turn around, and he would not do that. He just stared at my face. And, you know, and I told him, my grandmother told me I was pretty and smart. Do you think I'm pretty and smart? He said, yes. So I just said, we had to take it to the next level. So I asked him to be my boyfriend, and I'll never forget. He shook his head. No, I thought maybe he didn't hear me. So I repeated it. Need for you to be my boyfriend. He said, no. And I said, well, why not? I pressed him for an answer, and he changed my life by rubbing the back of my left hand with one finger. Mm. And I was like, what's wrong with my hand? And finally he said it. He said, you're black. Well, I was ready for him because my mother had purchased me a big box of crayons. And the first thing I did when I got my box of crayons was to find my skin color because I was tired of coloring. I wanted the people in my coloring book to look like me. And so I found my skin color. That's the first thing I did. And because he was I want him to be my boyfriend, I found his skin color too. I was ready for him. So
yeah.
When I was black, he said, you're black. And I said, I am not black. I am Sienna. And he got upset with me. And he said, you're black. So we went back and forth for a minute. Then I said, okay, if I'm black, what color are you? And he said, I'm white. And I said, no, you are not. You are salmon pink. And he got really upset. For the first time, I saw the back of his head. And I realized how ugly he was because he was, let me tell you why he was ugly to me. Because he was dumb, because he did not know his colors.
I said, I love that.
How did he get in school and he didn't know his colors. Oh my God, he was dumb. Yeah. So, you know, that started my lifelong journey about talking about race, because I went home and I told my mom, somebody called me a bad name. And I'll never forget what I said. I said, Mom, this little boy called me black. And she said, that's what they call us, baby. They call us black. They call us colored. They call us Negro. And I said, Mama, who is they? Because they need a box of crayons because they don't know their colors. And I became very defiant about my grandmother, holding on to my grandmother's words that I was pretty and smart. Those words have literally saved my life in many situations where I could have gone down the tube or gone down a wrong path. But what I realized something, Tanya, what I just found out, I mean, I hadn't paid attention in many, many years. I will be, and I will tell your audience, I will be 65 years old next month. And I have my pictures from that time, my school pictures. And I did not realize that 58 years ago, I had scribbled all over my face with an ink pen because of that incident. Okay. But guess what? Last week I had it edited and they removed the ink. Brilliant. And I saw my little 7-year-old face for the first time in 58 years. And it did something to kind of liberate me all the more to have these conversations on race and how it does impact. They say, oh, well, what do people think? Does it not impact us as children? It does impact us as children and how we see ourselves. And so I've been on a mission to help people using something I call the IPD, Identity, Purpose, Destiny principle that I developed. Because if you don't know who you are, you will never know what belongs to you. And I went on a mission finding out my identity, and it wasn't in what white people said about me. It wasn't even what black people said about me. It was what I thought about me. And so I realized that identity is such a critical piece in most black people, especially blacks in America, because we are descendants of enslaved Africans. Most of us have an identity issue.
Yes.
And when you have an identity issue, everything else is skewed. So I made up my mind to go about finding out who I am, not in terms of my tangled background, but in terms of who I am and what I bring now to the table. And when people say to me, well, you know, we'll invite you to sit so because of what you bring to the table. I told one man, I said, I don't need your table. I got my own tables. I said, the ancient Egyptians created the tables. I don't need your table. I mean, they were looking at me like I was nuts because they were acting me like they were doing me a favor. I said, no, you're not doing me a favor. When I come and I grace this table, I am the gift. I am the blessing because I can see things you cannot see. So, you know, I think that as people of color, we bring something very unique. We bring the rhythm to the beat, to everything.
Yeah.
And we bring the spice. Can you imagine just potatoes with no spice? Can you imagine anything you have without the spice? We bring the color, we bring the spice, we bring the rhythm, we bring the beat. We bring so much, and yet that has been minimized. And it's time for us to say, I will no longer be minimized. I will no longer be devalued. Because, you know, I just tell people straight up, when I have been abused or someone has said something to me, this is what I say. I am so excited for you because guess what? This is whatever you're doing to me is going to come back to your house. I said, it may not get you. It'll get your children. Oh, you have a wife? You have a mother? Oh my God. Look at what seed you planted for them because of how you're treating me. Let's celebrate. Let me tell you what, that changes the game, girl.
You know what? I have to intervene now. Cause I mean, there's a couple of things that you said. There's lots of things that you talked about. I mean, one on the last, but you're really talking about ancestral trauma there. I suppose on a deep level. And really, it was really interesting when you were mentioning what your mum said to you, being pretty and smart and your crayon box. I love that story. I just want to say that. And it kind of reminded me of something that happened to me when I was young, because my mum is the same complexion as you and my father's darker than me. I remember when I was probably about 8 years old, going to my mum and asking her why I was the colour I was. I remember that kind of conversation. And similar to you, I was brought up in a very much a white community where I was the only black girl in the class. It was kind of girl, kind of one Asian girl. I think about it. There was lots of ones rather than lots. Where I grew up. So when you're in that situation, you're faced with looking at yourself because everyone around you doesn't look like you. And then when I'm looking at mum, she's light. When I'm looking at dad, he's a lot darker than me. And she said to me, Tanya, your skin is beautiful. And she kind of basically said to me, like, the darker the berry, the sweet the juice.
Oh, yeah, girl.
And it was like, she just her saying that to me. Look, I looked at myself differently as a child, thinking, you know, skin colour is beautiful and it does glow. And, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, with black, it comes in all different shades, set shades, colours. And it was just that acceptance of myself as a woman and my complexion as well. And also a more acceptance of the people around me and the fact they were different. So we had that whole story and we talked about colour. And, you know, it just reminded me of how powerful that is. And there's too much hate, isn't there, in terms of hate of self and people not loving themselves and not loving their complexion or their colour. And all of that is just down to the media. And another thing that made me think was when I thought, when you mentioned something about the colour and how you perceived, I thought about Mae Mae Clark, you know, and I know you'll know this because you're a woman of a certain age, or I'm just guessing now, you'll know about Mae Mae Clark and, you know, and Kenneth Clark in terms of the Black Dole experiment. But I remember seeing that for the first time, probably about 10 years ago. And I've let my children watch that as well, because I thought it's really, really important for them to watch it, just to see how they reacted. And they basically said, gosh, mummy, why are black people calling themselves ugly? The children are seeing themselves as ugly. So my kids got it, and I just thought, phew, as a mother, you know, because I didn't want them to be mother, but I had to do that test with them just to see if they can understand what was going on at that sort of time.
Yes.
But my feelings are that we've gone backwards, not forwards. Because if I think about looking at that time in the 70s and all these psychologists are coming out and people are talking about race, I feel like things were moving forward and people had a voice. And I actually think now in 2020, I feel like there's a bit of a spiral back. That's my feeling, just in terms of looking at things from media, just in terms of looking at race relations. Some of the laws have changed. I mean, in this country, some of the laws have changed. So if you look at it, that's what's really scary. The fact that things in the 70s, people are fighting for the same thing they're fighting for now in 2020.
Let me tell you how I see it. I feel that this thing of racism is deep rooted. It's very deep.
Yeah.
And it's like when you it's like if you've ever had a tooth pulled, right? Why do you have your tooth pulled? You got pain. Okay, and before, many people don't want to rush to the dentist. They put all kinds of stuff on there to keep the pain down. And what happens is by the time you go, sometimes there's infection has set in. Your tooth is there, it's wiggling, it hurts, but you don't pay attention and you keep talking and act as if nothing's happened. That's racism. And by the time you get to the dentist, they've got to, you know, especially if it's a big tooth in the back, he's got to numb it. It's got to be numb. First of all, he has to acknowledge that there's something, probably infection in the tooth. It's a process. Yeah. And then he's got to numb it. And then after he numbs it, he's got to take that thing and move it around and then pull it out. So I believe, and then afterwards, if you have an infection, you get an antibiotic. I believe that we are in the stages where the tooth has always been there. The tooth has always been hurting and nobody really wanted to go. And the tooth keeps saying, I'm hurting. I need to be recognized. And let me give an example. I was on a thought leaders list and somebody says, I'm the only black on this thing. And it says, talking about race. And one of the people said in a chat to me, well, I just don't understand all the anger and violence. And it was a beautiful, pretty little white blonde woman. And I responded to her, being a pretty black blonde woman. I responded to her. I said, well, when a baby cries and you ignore it, the baby doesn't stop crying. The baby cries louder. I said, and the baby cries louder, you still ignore it. You only acknowledge the baby when they scream and they throw things because you have not changed the diaper. And I said, black people in America are like that baby. You have ignored our cries. Now you're asking about the anger and violence. What you're seeing is black pain. You're seeing black pain, and it's unanswered pain, non-responsive pain. You've been non-responsive. And I said, when Black Lives Matter came out, it became a clarion cry because we were seeing our young people die, be murdered in open form, and the world was watching us. And I said, every time we saw the videos, our people bled afresh. And I said, and so we said, hashtag Black Lives Matter. For the first time since Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, the senior citizens were talking to the baby boomers, who were talking to the millennials, who were talking to the Gen Xers, who were talking to the Gen Zs. We were talking across generational lines for the first time with hashtag in three words. Because we were watching our babies die. I said, and then what did white America say? All lives matter.
I had a poster at the time saying, what was it? Black Lives Matter. This little, I had a child saying, we know that Black Lives Matter. We know that all lives matter, but right now we want help with Black Lives.
Let me tell you what I said. I said, Black Lives Matter. And white America said, all lives matter. We weren't even talking to you. And I said, you have to butt into our conversations and you have to own everything. You won't even leave us alone with a hashtag and three words. Why are you so threatened by a hashtag and three words? We weren't even mattering to ourselves. It was a clarion cry for us. It wasn't about you. You make everything about you, and it's not about you. This is not about you. So I said, if white America had said, you're right, Black Lives Matter, we would not have the unrest that we have now. That's how much power you have as white people, but you chose to misuse your power. So guess what? You got what you got.
Gosh, you know what? We are on such a journey, and there, like you say, there is a lot of divisiveness as well. But that is what I want to kind of bring to the table is this whole divisiveness is not necessarily something that's been started by us, and so some people say, oh, this is a divisive behaviour. And I'm going to bring in the Nation of Islam as well. Do you know? I'm going to throw that in your thoughts on that as well. But yeah, that people are always talking about that. But divisiveness is not from us. It's systematic.
No.
It's systematic, and I think that's something that needs to be addressed, because it's almost like some things are thrown back in your court, and you're thinking, hold on a minute, I didn't create this system, but we're living in it, and we want to change it. We want to go through a process of decolonization, really. I feel that's what's important, you know, to kind of really come.
But when you're comfortable in something, Tanya, when you're comfortable in something and you're sitting on a cushion of white privilege and you don't even know it, you just know you're comfortable. The way that I explained it, I was speaking to a large group of white Christian women who are all authors and speakers, they're communicators.
Yeah.
And I said to them, listen, you're sitting on a cushion that your great-great-great-great-grandfather made my great-great-great-great-grandmother make for his behind. Mm. And I said, here's the thing. You have a chain around your neck with a key, and behind you is a warehouse. We don't want your cushion. We just want access to the warehouse. I said, because the soil of America is soaked red with the blood of my ancestors crying out, give us our 40 acres and a mule. You promised us stuff and you never have. We have not benefited from the Industrial Revolution. And I said, we're not asking that. I said, heck, we designed the Capitol. The work in America was done by Black people, Black engineers, Black labor. Everything this society has was touched by Black people, and yet you continue to minimize us. We don't want what you have. I said, but here's the deal. Your grandchildren right now who are out there on social media understand your hypocrisy. They've heard you on the phone talking about people negatively in your coffee groups, in your Bible studies, in your little social groups. They've heard you, and they will not tolerate it. And I'm talking about your white grandchildren. I said, and guess what? Get ready, because some of your granddaughters are going to bring home Black men. Some of your grandsons are going to bring home Black girls, and they are not going to care what you say, because they understand something that you probably do not, which is melanin ain't no joke. It's powerful. And I said, there is a wall in America, a brick wall called racism. It's filled with bricks. There is a brick with your name on it in that wall. It is forbidden for us to touch it, because your ancestors created it. It is systemic. If you want to tear down racism, this is what I suggest you do. Go to the wall and find the brick with your name. Take a Black person with you. Then and only then can we begin to dismantle it alone. But it must be something that is jointly dismantled. You must begin the process, because your people are the ones in power. You don't like what's going on, you begin the change. You are the most important factor in this equation. So my question to you is, what are you willing to do? I just got up.
You know what, coming back to you as well, because with regards to real stories and your kind of own personal story, obviously you've experienced racism, you talked about that conversation that you had when you were young with a crayon.
Sure.
But what's so lovely, I think, about you, Dr. Gale, is you haven't allowed it to stop you, which I think what is so important, I think, for so much people to know, because, you know, yes, we're faced with this every day, but it doesn't stop. It just gives you resilience and you push forward. Now, just I'm asking you just to tell my audience, where do you find that strength to keep going?
In the human spirit. And what I mean by that is having conversations like with white people. Well, I said, now, wait a minute. Like, you know, you're talking about my series, Five Things You Don't Say to a Black Person. Yeah. I do that on a regular basis. I said, now, wait a minute. Because I have some really good friends who are white. I said, now, wait a minute, girl. You know what you just said. Let me tell you why black people don't like that. I want to grab you and slap you. I'm not going to do that. So let me just tell you this. And they're like, oh, I didn't know. I said, no, you didn't know. I'm telling you so you won't say that to another black person. I have become kind of like a safe place for a lot of white people to kind of, and I don't get offended.
Because I
know that I always tell people, I did not come to offend, I came to inform. And I said, so therefore, there's got to be some of us who are, what do people call me? They call me a bridge between, or a conduit. Bridge or conduit between the races, the genders, the generations, and even the political parties. I am not typical, and I go into camps that are not typically associated with black people and stand there and say, hi, I'm here, and I don't leave, because I know the only way we can have these conversations is to go into places that don't generally, are not open to black people. Like, for instance, in America, we have the major political parties, the Democrat Party and the Republican Party. Well, I am a black Republican. And people go, how do you do that? I said, well, somebody's got to get in the room with these people. You know, you're standing out there on the street corner. You're standing out there on the street corner holding a sign, drinking out of paper cups. And I am in the room drinking out of China with my heels on saying, tell me, gentlemen, what is your problem with Black Lives Matter?
So you've got to get in there. You're right. You've got to get in there. You're going to make a change. You've got to get in there.
Exactly. You have to be in there with the decision makers. And I said, standing on the street corner and the media pans over you, they go home and go to sleep. They forget you. But you best to know they don't forget me. So yes. I'm just saying, when you see me over there, remember, I am like Maya Angelou. When I come, I bring 10,000 with me. But I just have this thing, and I just believe this is the way the Creator made me, that I'm defiant about certain things. I'm defiant about things that important that impact Black people, things that impact women, just women in general, but Black women specifically, because once you get with white women, there's some stuff that goes on. Okay, so what I do, you know what I do? I tell women, I'm talking to uteruses now, so let's talk. And I talk about things that women do to tear down each other. And I said, men don't need to get in the fight because we're so good at destroying each other. They just step back and watch us. I said, so ladies, how are we going to do this? I said, we should be smarter than this. I'm talking about linking arms and doing this thing, because without us, there is no birth. Let's do something. Let's birth something good. So I speak to women, and then I go and speak to men, because I've written books for men. Because I told you I was former law enforcement and I worked with men. Yeah. And so I help women understand men and communicate with them more vividly and clearly. Because really, men are quite simple, but we complicate it.
I want to clap for that. I do feel that.
They're so simple, but we want to go and download on them. And I said, shut up, go talk to your girlfriends. Give them bullets. If you want something, be simple and clear and concise. Don't give them all this stuff. They get lost in all the frills, because they want to know, they protect, provide, and serve. They want those three things. This is what they do. And it's like, for instance, one woman was saying, well, I have this door, and I told my husband I needed it replaced. And she goes on and on and on and on and on. And I'm listening to her, and I was tired. And I said, so I said, well, yeah. He hasn't done it yet. And she says, no. And I said, well, every time you ask him for an update on the door, you turn him, you take, you bring, you demote him. She said, what do you mean? I said, he's a king. You married him, obviously, he's a king. I said, so whenever you go to him for a progress report, you demote him to a boy. You only get progress reports from your son, not from your husband. So if you want something done, when is the best time to talk to your husband? Well, I said, no. When you're laying right here.
You're right. I love that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus.
Yeah, you talked to him right here.
It's extreme, but it's so true, isn't it, really?
It's true. Men don't hear you. I said, look, wait till you're right here, and you can tell him anything and get whatever you want. And I said, and then and every time you get a progress report, you tell him a different color of the door. He's got to keep looking for the door. He said, well, I thought you wanted that. No, I changed my mind. I'm like, what? He doesn't, look, first of all, men don't want anybody in their house. If they can fix the door, they'll fix it themselves, which is usually not the right answer. And they want to know how much it costs because they want to get something that's new, that's going to be sturdy. And they're going to check that door to make sure it's still safe because they want to protect you. But they're going to go and get a good door, and they have to have somebody in their house that they trust. And more than likely, they want to be there when it's replaced. And we don't think about those things, but they do. And they're looking at the cost. They're looking at never replacing that door again and also pleasing you. I said, so by the time he's going down the checklist, you're going, and he's like, oh, and you start over with something new. And then you say, well, he hasn't done it yet. I said, well, you need to shut up. And I said,
that's so brilliant.
Too much information.
So true, Dr. Gale. And you know, a lot of time it's just about control, isn't it, sometimes? I mean, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, but, you know, you can have the reverse role in nowadays. You've got some relationships, people are all about equal or being equal with that sort of thing. And that's the old fashioned way of doing things. And I'm totally with you. I do believe that's really important, really, in terms of looking at, you know, men and women and looking at men having their roles and women having their roles. And nowadays, I suppose, people are splitting those roles, aren't they? And that's where the conflict sometimes happens. That's my belief system, I suppose.
Yeah, but people don't talk about it. And you're saying, okay, because men come in with thinking one way, you come in thinking another, and then you don't know. You don't know how to merge those. It's sometimes difficult trying to merge those roles. And then they're like, well, I don't want to step on her toes. I don't want to step in her territory. Well, I don't want to step on his, because in our minds, I don't care who you are, it's still some tradition there. And because men are men and women are women, and men will go, I don't know if I'm supposed to do that. So you have to start the conversation, because they won't. And you have to start the conversation. Let's have a talk about that. Next time this happens, what did you see happen? Well, I don't know. I'm fine. No, you're not fine. That's what they'll say. And it's just like that. It's like that tooth that's hurting. Mm-hmm. The tooth hurts. You feel it the first time, but you don't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do something about it, by the time you get to the dentist, it's infected and you're sick. And so we have to stop things when we first see them and say, it's okay for us to talk about it. And say, look, I noticed there was some conflict here with us. You know, I was thinking, feeling some kind of way. I was feeling like I should be the one. And he's like, well, wait a minute. But I was thinking I was doing this, and he was trying to protect you, because he protects, provides, and serves. And you're thinking, well, you just think I can't do it. I'm incompetent. No. He was saying, I wanted to carry the weight of that, is what he's saying to you. And you're thinking, I want to do it, I'm a woman. And he's trying to protect you. And men want to do this. They want to beat their chest and say, I am king. And they want you to say, yes, you are. It ain't good. I'm just saying. But we forget that.
Yeah,
we
forget acknowledgement.
You know, I'm like, let him carry a car. You can't carry a car on your back, girl. Go, let him do it. You know, so then you can applaud him. It's easy. It's easier to applaud than to carry. I'm just saying. Anyway.
No, you're right. And you know, that's where ego gets in the way, isn't it? Sometimes it's just step aside. You think, oh my God, my ego's in the way of all of that. That's why we're not communicating. And it's the same with any relationship, and it's the same with the relationship with your children as well, you know? It's just about listening and acknowledging them. I love that.
Yes.
Absolutely brilliant. I'm loving talking to you today, Gale. I'm loving your whole ideas and your whole perceptions. But I also want to know who inspires you. Where's your more inspiration comes from, like growing up? Who was your biggest kind of inspiration?
Growing up?
Who does Gale look to, you know?
Oh my God, what a question. You know what, I'm one of those rare individuals who's never had a mentor. And everybody always asked me, who's your mentor? I was like, I've had a few sprinkles of people. My first real sprinkle of joy was my grandmother, obviously, when I was little, but she died when I was 6 years old. Yeah. But the next person that really inspired me was my sixth grade teacher, and she was white. Mm. And I'll never forget, I was always talking and always writing, and I'll never forget, I won the sixth grade writing contest, and she said to me, Gale, you are brilliant. You are a brilliant communicator. And I was like, I don't think so. She says, Gale, you are quick-witted, Yeah. You have a comeback for everything. And she said, and the way you write. So I wrote my first book, and it was awful. When I think back, it's called If I Were a Little Boy, because I didn't like being a girl, because girls seem to always, they always want you to be quiet and be a lady. I had a problem being a lady. I always had a purse with marbles in it and a gun. And I would carry that around. Oh, girl, I was little. I didn't buy dolls. I bought marbles and guns, but I wore dresses because I liked being feminine. But I would go down to the marble shoot with boys. And I'll never forget, I couldn't understand. I couldn't find any girls. I always wanted to play with dolls. I'm the oldest of seven. So I didn't want to play with dolls. I had real baby sisters and stuff. So I'll never forget, she says to me, you're going to be a brilliant writer. And I won the contest, and the first prize was a fountain pen. Mm. The second prize was a box of chocolates. So I went to the person who won the box of chocolates to Mr. Gray. And my teacher chocolates. She says, no, I will not sanction that trade. You're going to learn to write. You're going to write. And I was like really upset with her for a while. But you know what? And it's interesting that I have indeed become a communicator. Like she says, you lighten up. And I was the only little black girl in my class. She says, you brighten up the whole classroom. And she said, when you come in, we already know it's education is wonderful. And I was like, oh, really? That's what I bring to the party. So, you know, that was, I remember Mrs. Waple, a white woman who inspired me. My next one was my aunt, who was an educator. And I remember her saying to me, you really can't see yourself. I was 19 years old. She said, I wish you could see what I see. And she said, you're just so brilliant. And I'm thinking, I'm not brilliant. I'm not. And she was telling me, she said, you can do and be anything you want to be. You have to decide what that is. But I didn't know what that was. And I didn't really realize I have just kind of morphed into this person that I am. Because as you can see, my background is fashion. I've done fashion. I've worked on Capitol Hill in politics and won awards. Then I was in law enforcement. I have this very eclectic background. And I believe that the biggest inspiration for me have been the words, you can't do that.
Yeah, I know what, I love that. And it's almost, I actually feel it's very American as well. Because they always look at the British as a stiff upper lip. We don't tend to sing about our successes, you know, as British people, we don't tend to sing about your successes. Of course they're there. And sometimes you've got to dig and dig and dig and dig and dig until people really open up.
But like their tooth.
Sorry?
Like the tooth.
Exactly. That's a very, I'd say culturally, there's a cultural difference there. But what I have always noticed, you know, coming from a West Indian background, that wasn't my culture. That's the culture I've come into. That's not where I'm coming from. Because whenever there is a success in the family, you know, my parents are Jamaican, they're singing about it, man.
You bring the rhythm to the beat.
That's it. And that's a culture that's come in. And that's kind of what I'm loving about you in terms of, yeah, it's okay to sing about what I'm good at. It's okay to embrace what I'm good at. And it's okay just to take that lead with confidence. Because so much people do lack that confidence, don't they, in terms of being able to just see who they are, you know, and open up. And that's what I'm kind of getting just talking to you today. And it's just so lovely to hear about your inspirations. And what's lovely as well is to hear that a lot of people were your family and your teacher. Because it doesn't really matter if they're white, black. I mean, people inspire us for different things.
So I said the human spirit. It's a people. You know what? When I go and look for my tribe,
yeah.
I don't look for color. I look for people who are like-minded. That's who have the same kind of energy. Yeah. And a lot of the people that I've found who are like-minded, have a lot of energy, believe it or not for me, have been white men.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And you know what? I'm on a group. Matter of fact, later today, I'm on a group of thought leaders, international thought leaders. Almost all of them are white men. There are a few white females. I'm the only black. And I told them one day, they couldn't believe I said this. I said, look, I can't believe you guys are teaching diversity and inclusion and getting paid. I said, that's just like eating vomit. And they were like, I couldn't believe I said that. I said, how are you guys going to teach somebody about diversity and inclusion without having someone of color on your team? That's like eating vomit. You're not going to get any different results. And then I said, but I will say this for you. I like working with white men. And they were like, I said, because you guys will ask for the money. And they laughed at me so hard. And as a result of that, I have collaborative partnerships with white men. And I told him, as long, I said, I understand that you have the power. I understand that you are king, but you have to acknowledge that I too am queen. And they were like, I love you. I don't walk in thinking, well, these men have to do things for me. I don't do that. I said, we're sitting at the table. They're my equals because we all have to use this.
Yes, and exactly. We are, and I think that's the key, really, isn't it? You know what I mean? And that's, I mean, I come from the performance background. And I remember one of my mentors saying to me at the time, look, Tanya, don't be looking at these celebrities like they're better than you.
Yes.
And yes. You know, I thought, God, my God, yeah. And it doesn't even, and they got issues. I thought, my God, they got issues.
Yes. I mean, you know what? Because they don't know who really wants to be with them. If it's exactly what they do. Yeah. They want people who are authentic, and they can't find authenticity in that circle under that light. And so, you know, I say to people, everybody is equal. Mm. That levels the playing field. And I said, so when I go in saying, oh, where's my seat? I'm going to sit down. And people are like, you're so comfortable. I said, yeah. Huh? I said, we're all human beings. Yeah. Yeah. And I ask questions that nobody else will ask. I'll say, okay, so tell me about this. And they're like, what? I said, yeah, I want to know about you. And they're like, so I have people who give me their personal cell, you know, who are celebrities, when I go into a circle, because they know they can trust me not to violate their privacy, because I am not starstruck or in awe of them, because we're all human. And they look for people, like you said, in the entertainment, people who can be authentic, who can be real, who will not abuse that access. You know what I mean? And so this one, you know, I get it. I'm just like, okay, so what do you want? What do you want me to do? I just ask really pointed questions and understand that we're all human, and everybody is leveling the playing field. Everybody, we're just in different roles doing different things, and they know without people like you, without people like me who are counsel, they're gonna fall. Yeah. That light of celebrity is harsh. It's very harsh.
Oh, no, totally, totally, totally. And diversity is key. And you know what, at the end of the day, like you say, you just gotta be you. And I'm exactly the same. You know, I'm all about like-minded people. If I can roll with you, if you make sense, if you
get some
education, I do like a bit someone that's willing to educate themselves as well, a little bit as well. Otherwise, if you don't want to learn, if you don't want to grow, I can't hang out with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got to go to the next level. So I absolutely love it. So I'm totally with you. I'm gonna bring it to a close now, but before I bring it to a close, is there anything more that you'd like to say in terms of a quote by Dr. Gail or some words of wisdom? Mind you, you've given me so many quotes today anyway. So.
Here's one of my quotes, and I didn't know if you know this, but I am a quotologist. This is what I do. I do quotes. I actually got a book contract from my quotes off of Facebook. I got a book contract with a major publisher. And here's one of the things that I want to end it with this quote, and it's called Fire. And the question is, do you bring the fire with you wherever you go? Check it out. I believe that you do. Fire is bright. It says fire is bright. Fire is hot. Fire attracts attention. Doesn't that describe you? You see that everyone is not willing to bring the fire because most people are afraid of getting burned. But you, and I'm talking to you, Tanya, you are a woman of wisdom, strength, and power. So go burn it up, girl.
Oh, and I know, I love that. When you said you do bring the fire, I had to say, yes, I do. I wanted to go into that. I wanted to do a little bit of Beyonce there. Oh, dear, because I'm a fire sign as well. So, of course, I bring the fire.
Okay. We do.
Yeah. And I've been shutting it down for such a long time. It's like, embrace that fire energy, you know? Embrace it, man. Embrace
yes.
it. Yes.
Go burn it up, girl. Go burn it up.
I love it, girl. And I have to ask, are you a fire sign too?
I think I'm air. I'm Libra.
Oh, you're air sign. Okay, so you keep
air. Fire going. I'm Libra. Yeah, my birthday's coming up. Yeah. I like fire. Without air, fire cannot burn.
Yeah, exactly. You keep it going, baby. That's brilliant. I love it. Oh, okay, and I'm gonna say this is so funny. From telecommunication doctor and Dr. Gail, adios. Yes.
Wow, what an energy we just experienced with Dr. Gail. I love when she said, as women of color, we bring the rhythm to the beat and we bring the spice to the table, and that whole kind of acceptance of self. And I loved a lot of her stories, but one of my favorite was the tooth when the tooth has been there and it's always been hurting and you need to relieve the pain and nobody's listening, you need to step forward and just help that relief of the pain. And that's what Black people are going through right now. That's kind of the space that's needed in terms of helping and supporting. And you know, the pain's been going on for far too long, and it's about time that we did something about it instead of just living with the pain. I think that was a great analogy, and I feel that Dr. Gail definitely did help me bring the rhythm to the beat and the spice to the table today on Real Stories. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more Real Stories, don't forget to subscribe.